Sirocco by Andrew Wood and Alastair Morton. Disc 2. As the kidnapper withdrew the probe, Yusuf's body relaxed and swung back against the wall. His heart beat with a speed it could barely manage, and his broken and bleeding organs burned inside his body. His bladder emptied its contents, and urine ran down his leg, making a pool on the dry earth beneath.
"If you lie to me again, I will put this in your mouth," the kidnapper said menacingly. "What were you talking about?"
"He asked me if I knew about Sirocco and what it was. I told him it meant the desert wind,"
Yusuf replied, half screaming the words out of his body and with tears streaming down his face.
"What else did he ask you?"
"He asked me to try and find out what El Sirocco means. That's all, I swear it."
The kidnapper stepped back and let the probe fall down to beside his leg.
"How much did the American pay you?"
$1,000. You can have it. It's right here in my pocket."
As the kidnapper rummaged in his pockets, pulling out a bundle of notes wrapped tightly in a circle, Yusuf saw a chance to save himself.
"I'll help you. I'll work for you. I'll do anything you want me to. The American trusts me."
"You want to work for us?" the kidnapper replied.
Yusuf smiled and said whatever he thought would get him down from the chains, which had now broken through to the bone.
"Yes, I'll work for you."
"Okay, you can work for us. You can even have your money back," said the kidnapper,
and he placed the money back in Yusuf's trouser pocket.
"Thank you, thank you. Tell me what I can do for you. Anything, I'll do anything."
Yusuf looked around at each of the kidnappers and pleaded to each of them.
"When are you meeting the American again?"
one of them asked.
"Tomorrow afternoon, at 4 o'clock, at the cafe in the square where I met him today."
Yusuf detailed when and where he would be meeting Bob Charles again, and told his captors how he had known him and what he had done for him before. But as the final words left his mouth, he felt a change in the room, and he suddenly felt even more small and vulnerable than he had before.
"Well, your work for us is done, then,"
the kidnapper in charge said, partly to Yusuf and partly to the other kidnappers.
"And we don't want you working for the Americans anymore, do we?"
With this sentence, his face hardened, and he looked right into the eyes of his victim on the wall, piercing Yusuf's short-lived hope of survival, and telling him with this look alone what Yusuf feared the most. The kidnapper on Yusuf's left stepped forward, removed the money from Yusuf's pocket, and turned around to pick something up from the ground. Before Yusuf could see what it was, he felt the cold, sharp tip of the probe on his skin again, and the current surged through his body once more. When the current stopped, he opened his eyes and saw the room before him. For a moment, he thought he saw a car flick past the open window on his left, momentarily silhouetted against the half-crescent of the sun that still remained. But in a second it was gone, if it had ever been there. No one was coming. The kidnapper who had taken the money walked up to Yusuf and placed a clear plastic bag with a nylon cord over his head. The room became a blur as Yusuf strained to see through the plastic sheath that encased his head, and as he struggled on the chains, the kidnapper pulled the cord tight and knotted it. As Yusuf gasped for air, he unwittingly sucked the plastic onto his face and covered his mouth and nose. As he drew his last breath, he struggled and tore at the clasps around his wrists to try to reach his face, but the chains would not move. The kidnapper with the money handed it to the man who stood motionless in front of Yusuf's screaming body. He put it in his pocket without looking down, stepped forward, and struck the blood-covered Yusuf in front of him twice in the abdomen and then once in the head. Yusuf's skull cracked, filling the plastic bag with blood, and then there was silence. The pain and agony was over. Yusuf had looked for a forgiveness that was not there, and he had paid for this with his life, his body still suspended from the wall by the chains. The only sound to be heard outside was the closing of the car doors and the tires in the dirt as the kidnappers sped away. Inside, as the sun finally set, the room was plunged into a silent darkness, punctuated only by the slow but steady drip as blood ran down Yusuf's motionless body and formed a crimson pool on the earth below. Chapter 6. The following afternoon, Bob Charles left his office at the American Embassy and made his way through the city streets for Umoween Square. He had informed Jack that he was meeting with a Fred and was hoping that his meeting with Yusuf would provide some information on Sirocco. But he had no inclination as to what the code could mean. Although he had heard of the bombing in Boston the previous morning, he had not supposed that there was any link to the information that Yusuf was to provide him. Yusuf was a reliable source and had been an informer for Charles for many years, but he was small-time, known and respected on the streets, but not involved with any serious groups, and he was not known to have any direct connections to terrorist activity. All he could provide was the word on the street, the word that was passed between city dwellers. But this, despite its local limitations, was valuable, as it was not the kind of information that was open to Westerners. This information was dependent upon, but also subject to, the trickle-down theory. All information is passed from one person to another. And so despite Yusuf's lowly position, he could find out things that originated much higher than him. The accuracy of this could not always be counted on, though, as it would have passed through many men before reaching him. With this in mind, Charles made his way through the city to the meeting place. Keeping a low profile, or as low a profile as the color of his skin and his attire would allow him, he walked briskly along the tight and cramped streets as if he'd known them all of his life, at the same time wary and confident of his surroundings. Nearing 4 p.m., the crowds had died down, and the square was quieter, and the heat of the day had passed. But it was still uncomfortable for Charles, and his body sweated and strained in the still excessive temperatures. Charles was a middle-aged man, and he wore the years like badges on a uniform. His beard was untrimmed and graying, and the stone-colored jacket he wore looked as if it was as old as he was. He did not expect there to be any trouble, but his experience had taught him that it was better to be prepared than caught off guard. Or in this case, it was better to carry a gun and not need it than to need one and not have it. As the sun began its descent from its high point in the sky, his experience was strapped firmly across his chest, under his left arm, in the form of a Browning 9mm semi-automatic. When Charles neared the square, he checked his watch. It read 4:10. He was to meet Yusuf on the hour, and his informer was never late. He went to a market on the corner of the square and purchased a newspaper, so he could soak up some of the feeling that was gestating in the city, and also so he could remain in the square without attracting unwanted attention. After leafing through the paper, he slid it under his right arm and made his way to meet Yusuf. At this point, a car with two passengers, which had been sitting round the corner with full view of the square and unseen by Charles, roared into action. As Charles reached the middle of the square, the car drove at high speed straight at him. It all happened so fast that Bob Charles had no chance to get out of the way, and the oncoming car hit him. His body was sent flying into the air, and it rolled across the roof and hit the ground head first. The car sped off up the street and careered around a corner, and then it was gone, the noise of the engine that had been so loud only moments earlier quickly becoming muffled and distant. Charles's body lay still. The car had struck him head-on, and he'd taken the full force of the speeding vehicle. When the car hit him, his outstretched arm was broken as he tried to shield himself, and his head had crashed into the windshield of the car, leaving a blood-stained crack in the glass. His body had been thrown into the air, and now lay stretched out in the middle of the road, his legs broken and crumpled beneath him. He lay motionless and silent, and a thin trickle of blood ran down his face, his eyes open and staring at the sky. Within seconds, his body was surrounded as people pushed and prodded him to see if he was alive. But they got no response. He was already dead, killed immediately by the impact. The crowd of onlookers grew as his body lay open and unprotected. A young man frisked him and found his gun, but ignored the rest of his possessions. Aiming into the air, he pulled the trigger, and the crowd dissipated at the sound of the gunshot. As the people ran off, the man walked away, holding Charles's semi-automatic in his hands, and with this acquisition, the body was left alone, lying solitary in the street, discarded and ignored, like his other belongings had been seconds earlier. Miles out of the city, as the sun set across the desert, a couple of young boys were playing football. Kicking the ball across the sand and dust, it seemed a million miles from the chaos and violence of the city, the boys running and laughing with a youthful exuberance and innocence that hadn't yet been stripped from them. Kicking the ball back and forth, they chased each other around the road, which was deserted, except for their laughs and movements, and the derelict building that they knew so well and had played in many times, its shadow now spreading as the sun dipped in the sky. As the boys' game neared the decrepit building, the shadow seemed to move, stretching towards the boys, until they were playing within its spindling grasp. The ball bounced along, seemingly influenced by the elongated shadow, and it rolled towards the building and through the crumbling doorway. The boys ran after it and into the darkness within. The taller and older of the two boys searched in the black for the ball and noticed something at the end of the room on the far wall. Temporarily forgetting about the ball that had dominated his thoughts before, he walked deeper into the darkness towards the bulk that was hanging from the wall at the end of the room. And as he got closer, the object became clearer. The smaller boy had found the ball and had joined his friend, staring at the cloth-covered body in front of them. He reached out and pulled back part of the cloth, the remnants of Yusuf's shirt, to expose the bloodied face concealed within the plastic. The smaller boy stood motionless and then ran from the building. But the older boy remained, transfixed and incredulous at what he saw before him. He looked at the lifeless corpse. The plastic was cracked and the clothes were torn and stained with blood. The body had been here a while. The face had turned blue, and the eyes were wide open, staring out through the plastic. It was chained to the wall, and the arms hung up vertically, disguising the human shape it had once adopted. The boy stood still in front of the corpse, transfixed equally by fear and intrigue. It no longer looked like a person. The skin had become leathery and translucent, and it hung unnaturally, its limbs bending in a way that a body that was alive could not. The boy stood there for almost a minute, surveying his discovery. Then he turned and ran out of the building, leaving the body and the ball behind in the darkness. Back in the city, the news of the hit and run did not stay unreported for long. Once the crowds had moved on and it was safe, the incident had been reported to the police, and from here it had been reported up the chain of command. The U.S. ambassador was in his office dictating a letter to his assistant when the telephone rang. It was a call from the Damascus chief of police, who informed him that the embassy's press officer, Bob Charles, had been killed in a hit-and-run incident. The chief of police viewed it as an unfortunate incident, perhaps an accident, or at the worst, a crime fueled by the growing anti-American sentiment. But he had not conceived of it being a part of anything further. To him, Bob Charles was a lowly press officer, a government pencil pusher, who had the misfortune to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. "Are you sure it was Mr. Charles?" the ambassador requested, knowing Charles' full identity, and that it was unlikely it was an accident or an isolated and unconnected incident.
"I'm afraid so, sir, yes."
His thick Syrian accent softened by a Western colloquialism he'd developed through working with the American diplomatic community for many years.
"He had his diplomatic passport and press card on him. He's in the morgue at the Assad University Hospital. I'm very sorry.
Right. The ambassador processed the news quickly, fully aware of Bob's identity. Thank you for your call. If you're in agreement, I'll arrange to have his body collected and sent home to his family in America. The ambassador carefully concealed his suspicions from the start.
That's fine, the chief of police replied. I'll tell the morgue to expect your people to collect the body of Mr. Charles. Once again, I am so sorry. Please convey my condolences to his family.